Association of Portland. We'll talk about policing, changes at the Portland Police Citizen Review Committee, and a special screening of Alien Boy.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Minority Cannabis Business Association Marley Natural Expungement Day, August 27th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Village Ballroom in Portland. Expungement means to set aside arrests or convictions. Attendees that have applicable nonviolent cannabis-related crimes on their criminal record will leave the event with their expungement paperwork approved and processed by sponsored legal assistance. Again, that's the Expungement Day, August 27th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Village Ballroom, 704 Northeast Deakum Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition. Round 2, Sunday, August 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park in Clackamas. This is Round 2 in the Mad Bro Extreme Amateur Games. Winners are allowed to compete in the following competitions and in the final. Again, that's Extreme Amateur Games BMX Competition Round 2. Sunday, August 28th at D Block Indoor Skate Park, 8921 Southeast Jansen Road in Clackamas. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director. Applications are due by 4 p.m. Friday, September 2nd, at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Applications may also be emailed. Send them to hiring@kboo.org. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regard to the minimum qualifications. And please answer the question, why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/AM News. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, that's kboo.fm/AM News. And thank you.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am your host, Joanne Hardesty. I'll be joined shortly by Jason Renault. While he is en route, I want to update you on the latest Citizen Review Committee public hearing that took place on Tuesday at Maranatha Church. You may remember last week I spoke about the city of Portland's desire to change how police accountability, how police discipline is handled in the city of Portland. And it pretty much boils down to the city's desire to remove the community engagement portion of police discipline oversight meetings. And I was absolutely surprised that not one member of the Portland City Council showed up for this community testimony hearing for input on a major issue that they will choose to vote on in early September. It felt like it had nothing to do with engaging the city council about whether or not their proposal made sense, would work, and really was what the public wanted. It was really disappointing to be at what was billed as a public hearing and have none of the city council in attendance. I just thought that was disrespectful to the public that came with written and verbal testimony to give to their elected leaders about why this proposed change is wrongheaded, and moves us in just the opposite direction of where the public wants police accountability to be. And so I would recommend for those who took their time out of their busy life to come and testify that they should contact the Portland City Council members, starting with the mayor and the entire city council, and ask them where they were and why they were not interested in hearing the public's feedback on this a ridiculous proposal to change how the oversight system works. So here's the deal. The Department of Justice says national-backed best practices on investigating police officers is that it should take no more than 180 days for an investigation to be completed. Now, in the city of Portland's case, before the Department of Justice came to town, it could take years for an internal investigation to be completed. And the reason that these investigations take so long is not because of the Citizen Review Committee, but in fact because of the paid professional staff who drag their feet and doing investigations. And I'm talking about the staff at Portland Police Bureau under the IAD, Internal Affairs Division, that traditionally does 99% of investigations of police misconduct. And so it's not rocket science to realize that police officers drag their feet when it comes to holding other police officers accountable for their behavior. And so by the time it gets to the Citizen Review Committee, it only gets there if the complainant actually appeals the finding. Since the finding is 99.9% of the time the police did nothing wrong, sometimes the community actually doesn't go along with that investigative finding and seek community members to seek justice, and so seek to talk to community members to get justice. And so the CRC, under the settlement agreement, is limited to only 21 days in order to review the police review of police misconduct. The ludicrous thing about that is that the committee itself only meets once a month, and so they have very little time to review the investigative files. They have very little time to review the investigative files and very little time to do their own due deliberation. But for some odd reason, the mayor and the city council and the auditor have decided on this new scheme that basically just cuts the public out of the process. The CRC meetings are the only police discipline process that the public gets to sit in on, the public gets to weigh in on. And so this new scheme says that the public cannot weigh in on the individual cases of police misconduct. Instead, the public could do some general comments at the end of any CRC meeting, which is absolutely inconsistent with having people speak to the issue and either come and speak in support of the community member who's been harmed, or the police have been able to bring the police chief and other police officers in uniform to CRC meetings. And so the fact that now that won't change, but the public will have no opportunity to weigh in, is absolutely, I think, ludicrous and disrespectful to public accountability for police misconduct. And so as far as I know, it is still scheduled for September 14th, since the city council didn't bother to come out and hear the community testify in opposition to it. And just like the only other meeting that happened that the city council did show up for, that was a community hearing, even though it was not built that way. Everyone who testified in opposition to the proposal. And so just like this city council is prone to do, since the public is totally against it, let's make it law because it must make sense. You want to join the conversation? Give me a call at 503-231-8187. It is, oh, and this week, the Department of Justice sided with the city of Portland that the Community Oversight Advisory Board should take a 2-month hiatus to regroup. And again, this is one of those situations where the city, so the Department of Justice has decided since the COCL, the Community Oversight Community Liaison, wants to divorce the COAB, the Community Oversight Advisory Board, that they should just take a break while they reorganize and get resettled. And I think that is the worst possible outcome that the Department of Justice in the city of Portland are recommending to the public. I think the public has a right to have the Community Oversight Advisory Board fully operational. And the only reason today it is not fully operational is because the city council has not appointed their replacements to the COAB board, and the Human Rights Commission has not appointed their replacement. Now, the city keeps saying, well, they can't meet because they can't get a quorum. They have 8 voting members, and if the city council would appoint their people and the Human Rights Commission would appoint their person, that would be 5 additional people that would be voting members. So the city is the barrier that's preventing the COAB from being functional, and the Department of Justice is supporting their dysfunction by supporting the city's premise that they need to take 2 months off to regroup and get reorganized. And hopefully they are also making sure that the COCL takes 2 months off, because we certainly shouldn't be paying him for engaging the community around police accountability if, in fact, there's a 2-month hiatus. Does that mean he's given up 2 months of salary? Mm-hmm. Does that mean that the city is going to renegotiate or look for a new contractor in that 60 days? That would make sense. If they were actually going to get a new contractor, then I would support shutting down the process for 60 days, because in 60 days, you could have a new contractor who would be ready to actually work with the community. Okay, so I'm going to stop my pontification because Jason Renault is here. And Jason, it's a pleasure to have you here. Traffic's getting a bit challenging in the city of Portland, is it not?
Man, next to police reform, it's traffic congestion. That's really what we got to work on.
We'll do that next year, right? Because we'll fix police in 2017, so 2018 we'll fix that.
Wow.
So welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Jason, I didn't introduce you, so I should say that you are in charge of the Mental Health Association of Portland, longtime community activist, and my go-to person when I need to talk to someone about the mental health and mental health services and how police and mental health engage. And so welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And so you walked in while I was pontificating on this new proposal to suspend the COAB for 60 days.
There's an interesting other point. The calendar comes into play in that the city, all the parties to the agreement are going back to see Judge Simon in October.
Yes.
And that's within that 60-day envelope. So really nothing's going to get done until the parties get to Judge Simon, and they're going to probably ask him to make major changes to the COAB and COCL process. So I think this is probably it for the COAB. The City Hall had no interest in appointing new members, and so they don't want to disappoint people by setting them up to go to a committee that's not going to happen.
Well, I think that's, needless to say, it is backwards. And you're right. The fact that we have a hearing in front of Judge Simon in October really means that unless they're working now to get a new COCL and to actually set up a new structure, or actually to just fully populate the structure that we have. The problem is that we don't have a full committee. That's one problem. Another problem is, of course, the COAB and the COCO want to divorce each other. My biggest concern is that the Department of Justice is operating as if the divorce has been granted. The COCO is operating as if the divorce has been granted. And City Council has been totally absent from the entire conversation.
Well, right. We have a police commissioner in Portland who has been a non-present character in the police reform issues for his term. That's Mayor Charlie Hales.
Right.
And his absence from the meeting last night was exactly the sort of behavior we've seen from him over the last almost 4 years now.
I was just absolutely appalled to think that here's a public hearing on a huge public policy decision, and not one city council member bothered to show up.
Well, I think it shows that that meeting actually wasn't that important.
Yes.
That what they were doing is sending out the city attorneys to basically float the same proposal that people had said was terrible a month ago.
Yes.
And they're looking to burn off steam from the community, to float out some new ideas, to continue to show their face in the community as if they haven't vanished completely in the hot month of August. But there wasn't any action going on there.
None.
No deciders in the room.
Yeah, I left early because once I realized that, why would I give public testimony to a city attorney? Right? That's a waste of my time. She doesn't have a vote on the city council. We have a caller on the line. Good morning, Francis. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I was calling to ask about the hearing in front of Judge Simon in October. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Now, as I understand it, he did not let go of this agreement because he wants to continue monitoring it because apparently he had some concerns about the follow-through.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, it doesn't seem like they followed through at all.
Well, I think they did follow through, but not in the way the community would have wanted them to follow through. Right.
And is the community going to be able to speak to the judge when we have this hearing in October?
I think it will be exactly like the last hearing. I think the public will be allowed to attend. I think, the thing about Judge Simon is he's really interested in hearing from the public. So I think everything will depend on whether or not there's a large public showing at the hearing. I think it is scheduled to be just the city, the PPA, the DOJ, and of course the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform are the only ones that are scheduled to speak. But Judge Simon has in the past invited the public to speak. And so I think it's just going to be just how interested he is in hearing from the general public that day. But, you know, Judge Simon reads the paper. So I believe that he's very aware of just how dysfunctional this process has been. And I think the DOJ and the city of Portland are setting the community up, because what Judge Simon has said from the very beginning is that he has no ability to change anything in the settlement agreement. The only people that can change the settlement agreement is the city of Portland and the Department of Justice. Those are the two entities that can change the settlement agreement. So this illusion that somehow we're going to wait till we get in front of Judge Simon and then somehow he's going to fix it is just an illusion, because that's not, Judge Simon has no power to change one word of that settlement agreement.
It's not possible for him to find them in non-compliance?
He can find them in non-compliance. That's his only power.
Right.
But if the Department of Justice has already given them a free ride because the letter they sent out said that they would not find them in non-compliance for this 60-day period because they are agreeing to this 60-day break.
Well, one of the things we found in the letters that were published, the email correspondence was published yesterday in the Portland Mercury's website, is that there's an active conversation going on between Tracy Reeve, the city attorney, and we should talk about her, and the Department of Justice. They are talking far more than the public is talking
right.
with each other about the details of the settlement agreement and the process that we're under, that's underway.
Oh, I have and to go I, check that out. I didn't see that. Go ahead, Francis.
Yeah, that's what's disappointing to me. The Department of Justice, you know, I know, Joanne, you've talked about it. We thought when they came to town that they would, you know, fix things. But apparently they're just kind of cooperating with whatever.
Well, Portland is a unique situation where the Department of Justice was asked to come to the
right.
city by both community members and the police commissioner. And the police commissioner and then police chief, that was Sam Adams, mayor, and Mike Reese, the former police chief, fully cooperated with the Department of Justice so that they were able to come to their findings very quickly and with not much staff time. So we've had a very cooperative relationship with the Department of Justice from the beginning. Everyone wants this problem to be solved. I don't think anybody knows how to solve it, but everyone wants this problem, and they're working together closely.
Well, they're working together closely. I don't know how determined they are to solve the problem, but that's another story.
yes, I mean,
they're providing the appearances of working together and doing what they're supposed to do. But
and hopefully the public doesn't forget that the Department of Justice created these police departments that now we're supposed to believe that they're going to fix. They incentivize excessive force, excessive targeting of various communities. And, you know, even today, you can write to the federal government if you're a police agency and get millions of dollars to fight drugs or gangs or, you know, any kind of community ill that the federal government wants to put money behind. And so, I mean, so police departments around the country have become very creative in writing for their federal grants so that they can get this enhanced money and resources. And I think that's the part that the public forgets, right, is that the Department of Justice created these police forces. And now we believe, or we thought when we invited them to town, that they were here to fix it. And I believe now they're just here to make it look like they are doing something. I mean,
right.
you know.
They're supposed to be the Department of Justice
right.
Civil Rights Division,
right.
and I don't believe that the civil rights are even being considered in any of this.
Well, not to mention that the DOJ Civil Rights Division is the same division that goes to court and defends police officers for killing unarmed community members.
Okay.
They're the exact same. It's the same department that does that. So, you know, so I don't have a whole lot of confidence that the DOJ is going to fix our problems. But I hope we, the people in Portland, will take a much more active role so that when the next police commissioner takes office, that he knows that the community has a set of expectations that they expect him to fulfill.
Well, I want to put another spin on that, Joanne.
Okay.
Excuse me, Francis. It may also be that the Department of Justice doesn't know how to fix this problem, and that they've put out this laundry list of minor repairs, things that basic maintenance should have been done to the Portland Police Bureau years ago, which we call the settlement agreement. But that doesn't culminate in making everyone happy.
No.
And, you know, for example, the racial justice issue is completely sidelined by the settlement agreement.
Even the little piece that's in there, right, which is the data collection piece, nothing has happened since the settlement agreement was filed with the judge.
And so there's no power.
Go ahead,
Francis.
I hope that the Judge Simon hears all this, because to me they're not in compliance at all. And he has the authority to say they're not. And if they're not, then will the Department of Justice take the next step, which is to sue the city, or what?
No.
Are they just going to let this go on and on and on and on and on?
I don't think that they have any interest in suing the city. But we'll see. I mean, you know, I appreciate the call. I'm just thoroughly frustrated. I just think that we have spent millions of dollars over the last couple of years, 99.9% inside the police bureau in IPR, and absolutely nothing has changed as far as the operations of Portland Police Bureau. The only thing that's changed is the leadership of the Portland Police Bureau. So thank you very much, Frances.
All right, you guys take care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye. Have a great day. And so I do want to circle back, because I don't want to forget that I want to talk about there's going to be a special screening of the James Chassie film, and that's going to take place on September 17th. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. September 17th is an interesting day. It's going to be the 10th anniversary of the death of James Chassie.
Wow. 10 years?
10 years.
Wow.
10 years.
It does not seem like it's been that long.
It seems like it's been that long.
Depends on where you sit, I guess.
Yeah, we've been doing advocacy. Our organization had been looking to follow a case of a person who, with a mental illness, who was harmed by a government institution. And
right.
We looked for several years and talked to some really unhappy families. And then James Chassie died. And we immediately picked up the cause of Chassie because he was a personal friend of mine, and we knew his backstory very well, and we knew that we could, by telling his story from the day that he died until the final culmination of whatever was going to happen,
right.
We would enlarge the understanding of this conflict between police and people with mental illness for everyone. And we've done that for the past 10 years. And that's going to culminate in an event on September 17th. That's Saturday. We're going to start at 5 o'clock with the screening of the film at Saruman House. And if you haven't been to Saruman House, you really need to go.
It's a beautiful place.
It's a restored fraternal lodge, mm-hmm. done by our friend, great friend Randall Stewart and his colleagues. It's just a wonderful space for meetings, small and large. We're going to show the film there. And then we're going to have a conversation afterwards. And Joanne, you're going to come and help talk at the conversation. And the conversation is going to be called Bearing Witness. Mm-hmm. And the question is, where are we now after 10 years of Chassie, after years of working in police reform? Where are we now in this process of the community understanding how police operate and being engaged in civilian oversight? And in the witnessing is, once you have become interested in this issue, once you have seen an event occur, what is your responsibility as a citizen? Where do you go with that feeling, experience, knowledge? What do you do? What's the do statement?
Right.
So we're going to answer that question. What do you do to help increase the participation with police reform?
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. So September 17th.
You need to get tickets because they're going to go fast. This is a donation event. It's free, but we'd appreciate a donation to cover the expenses of Saruman House. Saruman House is at 5131 Northeast 23rd Avenue. And if you come to the website for the Mental Health Association of Portland or Saruman House, you can click on the link to brown paper tickets and get yourself a ticket. It's going to sell out, so get on it now.
And that is a beautiful space. I saw hands up there a couple of times.
Oh, wow.
Yes, it's a beautiful, beautiful space.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was maybe had been a church, but it was a lodge, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, very interesting. You want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. You had something you wanted to say about Keaton Otis.
Well, yeah, there's a little development in the Keaton Otis case. As Joanne, you know this case much better than I do. 2010, Keaton Otis, driving through Northeast Portland, attracts the attention of a couple of police officers who follow him, stop him, and end up shooting him many, many times.
Right, 26 times.
The officer who shot Keaton Otis 11 times, Cody Byrne, has just joined the office of the Multnomah County District Attorney.
No.
Yes, he went back to law school and worked at Miller Nash for a couple of years and has now been picked up by the Multnomah. So the persons who would have prosecuted him are now his colleagues.
Wow. Well, that really shouldn't be that big a surprise, but that is troubling to say the least, that now he's on the prosecutorial side of the equation.
So we've talked in the past about how difficult it is for district attorneys to hold police officers accountable.
Right.
and how rare it is that police district attorneys indict any police officer for use of force. In fact, we did a survey a year or so ago mm-hmm. of all the district attorneys in Oregon, asking them if they had ever indicted a police, and none of them could remember in their offices ever having indicted a police officer for use of force.
Well, we know there's only been one in Portland.
Actually, there's one. That's right. One. And that's true, and that's in Multnomah County.
Yes.
And that was Officer Dane Reister.
Yes.
In 2012.
That is true. I am speaking to Jason Renault with the Mental Health Association of Portland. You want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-1187. I know the number. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to KBOO.
Ethan.
Ethos.
Oh, hello.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, Ethan.
I'm sorry, what was your name again?
I have to admit that I've called you before, and I agree with 100% with everything you say.
Well, thank you. That's rare.
One question I have, I did join a little late, is I know you focus a lot on police issues, and I'm an African-American. I've been harassed my whole life by police. One thing that I wish we could talk about or try to figure out in terms of, like, the issues around with black folks in particular is we know all these facts, we know all these disparities, we know the percentages, we look at the prison arrest rates, we know all of this. The poverty is the biggest issue that impacts everyone. If you're
right.
poor, you're screwed,
right.
essentially, in this country. And so the thing is, what are we going to do about that to really, you know, because we know these things are true, but yet we sit here, we talk about it, we talk, we get the information out. You know, it's like, how do we honestly make the changes that need to occur to uplift our people out of poverty so they can be in those same situations and not have to deal with a limited set of options that are of basically a viability because of their poverty? Like, what are we going to do about that? You know, we can, you know, Trump, Clinton, it's almost like 1984. I mean, this isn't
yeah,
real.
That is a $60 million question, and it's a great question. And there are pockets of places where I get hope. There is the African All Peoples Ajamu's group, All African Peoples Political Party, I believe is what it's called. They are modeled after the Black Panthers. They have a breakfast program at New Columbia where they are feeding schools children every day. They are creating a community police force where they're training community members to cop watch to keep the community safe. So there are pockets of activity happening. I think the biggest challenge is resources. How do you get resources to really invest in something that is specifically for African American community members so that they can build their own businesses, create their own education environments, do the things that have not happened since the civil rights movement provided that promise? I think that's what you're talking about. And that's the challenge. And for me, I'm looking into like new industries, like the emerging green energy field. I mean, there's an opportunity, I think, for African Americans and other low-income people to really get in on the ground floor with little training, with not a lot of resources, to be able to create some living wage family job opportunities, as one example. But I think that there needs to be a lot more examples like that of how we get in on the ground floor. I mean, the marijuana industry is a great example.
Can you believe that?
Right. I mean, that's talk about a great example of a industry that has devastated the African American Latino community. But fast forward a decade or more, and now you have middle class white men getting filthy rich.
Right.
They are legal drug dealers, exactly. What I know about the marijuana field is that if you don't have $500,000, you can't open up a shop.
There you go.
Right.
They
so So that's the barrier. But I wonder if there's a political will in the legislative body to create some kind of legislation that creates a co-op that would allow people that have been left out, people who've been victimized by marijuana policy, to actually be able to collectively open up a shop together. Maybe that's a legislative proposal. Maybe that's a pilot where we take people. I'm sorry?
They're doing that now. There's a one across the street from my house that is a co-op.
And oh, really?
The thing is that, yeah, and it upsets me because the thing is the minute that any kind of movement will start, that where people have, a fact-based argument, it quickly becomes infiltrated by, like, the FBI, let's say. That happened with Occupy Wall Street right away. You have the FBI shut that down.
Oh, right. Well, you know, the FBI, anytime the community organizes en masse to demand justice, the FBI, now Homeland Security, you know, the local police, we are under so much surveillance, you just never know who's watching. And so I don't worry about that. I figure they're always watching, they're always reading email, they're always listening. So that's just a fact of life when you're working for justice. But I would recommend that you have a conversation with your state legislator and see if they can be creative in thinking of a pilot program that actually would create an opportunity to develop a co-op so that people who've been harmed by marijuana policy in the past can collectively come together and become legal marijuana store owners and operators. I think you should talk to your legislator about that.
I think I should look into that because, like I said, we sit and talk about all of this stuff. Yeah. I'm not trying to be mad. I'm passionate when I speak.
I hear you. I agree.
I think about it, and I think, man, this is just crazy because if nothing is in favor, you know, like I said, you can look at who goes into the dispensaries. It's all, you know, yet they put all of the people who were trying to feed their kids too out of business.
Yes, right. Oh, yeah, we could spend the rest of the time talking about this,
sure.
But I think...
Yeah. We agree to disagree. Disagree, but agree all the time. I agree with 100% of what you say.
Well, I appreciate that, so there's two industries, right? The clean energy industry is another industry. I mean, when we start thinking about solar panels, the first time I heard about solar panels was when... Van Jones was doing solar panels in Richmond, California, working with high school dropouts, teaching them to build and install solar panels. We need some creativity in Oregon
threw him under the bus too. Remember that?
Oh yeah. Yes, they did, but it didn't hurt him much.
No. Van Jones is all right, but yeah,
they tried to take him out, but they didn't hurt him too bad. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Have a fabulous day.
You too, Father. It's a pleasure listening to you.
Thank Likewise. You. It's a pleasure having you listen. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
And calling. Have a great day.
Okay. You too.
So, Jason, you want to weigh in on that? Is there any opportunities you can think of for emerging businesses that will help communities who've been left behind in this economic engine?
Well, gosh, I'm the last person in the world, I think, who's still a marijuana prohibitionist, so I think I probably not weigh in on that. I think marijuana has done more damage to our nation than most other drugs except alcohol and tobacco. And until we have an actual treatment for marijuana addiction, the government has no business, no moral business participating in it. So, but
having said that,
that boat has left the dock.
Yes, it has.
No, the a great way that people can get involved in small business, in helping the community, and especially people in minority communities, is to start creating opportunities for low income housing. And there's a lot of money at the federal and state government available. There's a lot of technical support available through the housing authorities in your community. And it's not that hard to get involved with. So we're actually looking at that now and starting to learn about how to develop low-income housing for marginalized populations. So that's actually a business that is there's a desperate need for it here in this community.
Right.
Government officials are bending over backwards to help people get involved, and banks are available to help people finance loans through things like the low-income housing tax credit system. So lots of opportunities there.
You said a mouthful, so I'm just going to ignore all the prohibition conversation because that will take me off track for the rest of the program. I'm going to pretend you didn't say that. We're going to go back to the phone line.
This is KBOO.
X34. He's gone. Call back X34. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. So, Jason, do you have any hope that we have moved the needle at all in police reform?
Yeah, here's some interesting ideas. There's another anniversary that's coming up, which is November 15th, I think, which is the anniversary of the death of Michael Johnson. Michael Johnson was shot by Portland police officers while contemplating hurting himself in the parking lot of Good Samaritan Hospital. Mm. But he was the last person the Portland Police Bureau killed. And so we're going to get through a whole year now, I'm hoping. Everybody keep your fingers crossed.
Fingers and toes crossed, right.
A little time to go, but we've been a long time since the Portland police have shot and killed someone.
And but unfortunately, all the people they've killed since the Department of Justice has been in town had a mental health issue.
Well, actually, we could say that all the persons since Kendra James have had issues with alcohol, drugs, or mental illness, and were likely impaired when they had their encounter with the police. So that's ongoing, and Michael Johnson was certainly impaired when the police were encountering him. But there may be, and this is statistically irrelevant, that it's just one in the past year. We've gone over the years somewhere in the range of between one and five or six, ranging with the median of about 3.1, 3.2 per year. So this is not a statistical, it's a little bit of an outlier, but it's not statistically strange, but it may be an indication that the police are waking up. I don't think that our reform efforts have had any effect. Mm. I don't think that those changes people have talked about incessantly have actually been operationalized. I do think that new police officers have been hired over the years who are younger, smarter, and probably more engaged with their personality, with their own emotions, with their individual capacity to be compassionate. And I also think that there's now a great peer pressure on police officers to be more engaged with people who are impaired rather than simply act with violence, act with force. And that peer pressure comes with the media. It comes with public participation in these police reform events. It comes with the engagement of police administration in making this a priority. It comes with following the national story that's going on from Ferguson, from North Carolina, from all these other communities, from Milwaukee, that are having trouble with this issue. So I think police officers themselves are probably thinking more about this than ever before.
I don't disagree with that, but I do think that any long-lasting reform has to start at the top. We have to have a police commissioner that can articulate the kind of police force that they want to have. We have to have a police chief who absolutely is committed to policing in a way that's different than the Portland community is accustomed to. And we have to have a city council that doesn't leave policing to the mayor, but in fact sees that the entire city council has a role and a responsibility in the reform that's been set out in the settlement agreement.
Well, great. Let's break all those down because lots of change is going to happen in the next few months around that. We're going to have a new mayor.
Right.
Which means a new police commissioner.
True.
We're going to have a new city council, same members of the city council for the most part, but pressure on them to continue to be engaged with police issues. They're pretty disengaged at this point.
Totally disengaged.
Pretty disengaged and pretty not knowledgeable, I would say. And then third, we're going to have perhaps have a new police chief. We do have a new police chief now. And whether he is continued by Wheeler or not is unclear. Wheeler has said he's intends to do a national search, and Mike Marshman, the current police chief, is welcome to apply for the position. But Marshman, what's your thought on Marshman so far?
It's too early to tell. He's been accessible. He's been making the rounds, but it's too early to tell. Mm-hmm. I mean, I come to Marshman with the understanding of how he got to the settlement agreement, which was he was hired by Reese, Mike Reese, to pretend reform was taking place. I, in fact, still have the PowerPoint presentation when Reese was running around saying that we were 85% done with the reforms of Portland Police Bureau that Mike Marshman put together under the direction of Reese, Mike Reese. And so I have that in the back of my mind always, and I've taken a very wait-and-see attitude for the reasons you've mentioned. A, he may or may not continue to be the police chief. And B, he's very new in the position. So far, he's been responsive, receptive, open, but it's early.
We have some advantages with Marshman. He has been participating with the police reform effort. He's gone to almost every one of these co-ad.
Well, it's because it was his job.
It was his job.
He was the inspector.
Of some sort. He was the liaison from the police bureau to the COCO COAB meeting. So he's been to all of them. He's read all the documents. He knows all the people. He's fully knowledgeable about how it's been working. That document that you're mentioning, the 85% done, interesting problem that when you have the police bureaus mandated to make these 180 changes we see in the settlement agreement, they're anxious to get it done. They're anxious to get it done. And They have staff to do this. They have 6 data analysts. They have quite a few staff to.
They've hired quite a few people to assist with this.
To monitor and to say, are the changes occurring?
Right.
And they're anxious to get the Department of Justice out of town. So Marshman's job was to oversee that and make sure that that was actually occurring. The Kokel's job was to make sure that the Bureau
presenting
was
it well.
True,
right,
was
right.
Presenting true facts.
Right.
And the COAB was there to make sure that the COCL was doing its job. And with those two functions out of order for not just this week, but perhaps months and months, the police bureau has been going along its merry way, operationalizing all these changes and assuming that they've gotten things done. We may come in several weeks or months from now, when we get back from Michael Simon, with a new understanding of how we're going to supervise these changes, and some schism between what the police officer, police department has done and what the settlement agreement says they should do.
Right.
How will we know that that's occurred? Marshman's going to be key in that, whether he's chief or not.
That will be a very interesting conversation. Did you read the last COCO report? Because my experience in reading the report is that the COCO bends over backwards to assume goodwill from the police bureau, which is not their job. Their job is not to say, oh, well, we think that they want to do good, they, you know, even though we haven't seen it yet, but we're going to give them a partial grade because we know that they want to do it. If you read the COCO's written reports on their findings of whether or not the settlement agreement is being fully implemented, you have to really read between the lines because it's written in such a way. I think the last report, there were at least 10 incidents where the COCO said that they were in partial compliance, but the police bureau said they hadn't even started yet on whatever that data set was that they were supposed to collect. And so I am also suspect of the COCO's report. So when they write a report, I wait to see, well, what is the Department of Justice going to say about this report? Because that's really, I think, the community's best observation into what's really happening around reform is when the Department of Justice actually reviews what the COCO has said has been accomplished in the process, right? In the first report from the DOJ, clearly pointed out a lot of areas where the COCO was acting too favorably and assuming that the police bureau was really making those reforms happen. I mean, whether you're talking the after action reports. You know, there are just so many different areas that aren't being implemented, even with the mental health training, right? We have never fully implemented the Memphis model. Right. No. The DOJ has called out the police bureau on it. The COCO has kind of called them out on it. But the Portland's going to do what Portland's going to do. And they don't want to fully implement the Memphis model, even though that's what's in the settlement agreement. And so, again, we're depending on the DOJ to hold the police accountable and the city of Portland accountable. And they're not even holding them accountable to what they have agreed needed to happen.
Boy, we have a lot of – this is a lot of inside baseball, Joanne.
I know. A lot of detail. We know too much.
Let me back up and say to the listeners that there's a way that they can get involved just right now is go to your computer and look up COCL, C-O-C-L.
Slash C-O-A-B.
C-O-A-B. Mm-hmm. And you'll get a nice, simple website which has the calendar of events and all of these documents that Joanne is referencing. It also has a link to – the videos. The city of Portland has been kind enough to videotape the general meetings of the COAB. So you can go back and look. And some of these is a little tedious. Mm. They're long. But if you want to get knowledgeable about all these things we're talking about, that's the meeting to be watching. Mm-hmm. The next thing to do is get up and go downtown and come to the Citizen Review Commission meeting and start to listen to these appeals of police decisions about various infractions that officers get involved with, none of them having to do with use of force or bias or discrimination. Those have to go to the police review board. But there's some basic knowledge you can pick up there as well.
Absolutely true. And since we're on this mode of what you can do directly, you could also contact either the mayor or one of your city commissioners and say you would like to be part of the COAB. You would like them to appoint you to help with this reform effort. They claim nobody wants to be on the COAB. And so if you contact them, you should have a really good chance of being appointed to the COAB board.
We did have a commissioner contact us about 2 weeks ago asking for names for the COAB.
About 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We've been only trying to get them to do that for 6 months.
They haven't acted on it, but they right. do have the names now.
Ah, very interesting. We got callers stacked up. We're going to try to do this quickly. Hello, Gina. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for giving me the time to express myself. I was just listening to your guest there, and I know you didn't want to touch the prohibitionist attitudes that were represented, but I'm going to because I'm particularly passionate about the cannabis industry as well as it as a medicine. So I just want to say that those attitudes are the very thing that has fueled law enforcement to disproportionately stop and prosecute people of color specifically. But there are also other people throughout the state that are also marginalized, rural people who don't have access to, you know, all kinds of different things that would make their businesses successful on any kind of small business level, but specifically in the cannabis
industry. Well, I would greatly endorse the use of the tax funds that coming from cannabis to for reparations to the communities that were improperly incarcerated.
Well, that
decades.
Needs to be looked into how all of these funds are going to be distributed. Yeah. Because on a small business level, it's really crazy to me that dispensary owners have to handle upwards of $60,000 monthly in tax cash payments.
Well, and since
with no banking option.
There isn't a treatment for a marijuana addiction, giving that money to mental
health
actually, and addiction treatment.
You need
is
to look
worthless.
At bottom line statistics.
Oh, I
what's
know it very well.
Addictive is opioids.
Oh,
so
yes.
In terms of a treatment of
no,
chronic
no
pain,
disagreement.
PTSD and things like that, cannabis is definitely a legitimate medicinal treatment. So I'm also looking forward to as more states come online with medical or recreational legal use, that more funds get allocated to medical research. Because I'm really
Another
upset show. When you say cannabis addiction. It has been proven that it's not addictive, and it's actually treatment to alcohol addiction and opioid addiction.
Well, thank you very much. I didn't want to get down this road, but you did, and I appreciate you going down. I was going to have a wherewithal with Jason offline, but thank you very much. I appreciate
you
calling. Have a great day.
Have a great day. You too.
Thank you. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Hello, Crystal. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi.
Hi, Crystal.
Jason and Joanne, I so appreciate you and your work. You are the ones, along with Dan Handelman, who years ago got me involved in this. I will say, since we're already on the topic first, about marijuana, I come from a huge libertarian family in Arizona who have always, since the beginning of time, supported the availability of, you know, drugs. So I do support, I agree with the last caller in that sense, but I do know people who are addicted just as they are to anything because they have addictions. And right. So, of course, we need universal health care and programs to help people, but that's not why I called.
Okay.
Earlier on in your conversation, you mentioned those who shall not be named, but unfortunately we have to, Mike Reese, Charlie Hales, call him Charlie Holes, and Mike Marshman.
Yes.
Chief Reese, Mike Reese, who is now officially our sheriff, appointed by somebody who should have left in shame, but somehow got his vacation and retirement and got to appoint whoever he wanted.
Yes.
As a slap in the face to the people of Portland, he appointed Mike Reese. Now, Mike Reese was not, as Jason noted, you know, and so how did you phrase it, that he was 100% compliant and following through on this DOJ settlement. In fact, with Charlie and Mike and their conflicts that they ended up splitting many times, actually, but eventually he resigned, and for some reason he's back. And I'd say that in this role as sheriff, which is also fraught with the same sort of issues, it's a mess.
Yeah,
and he, I'm sorry, so he just said he basically, from the get-go, he was a bit snarky about it. He said, like, oh, we already, you know, we support the DOJ settlement, but we've already for years now had all of these things in place, most
right.
of these things. And I thought that was just shocking. And so Mike Marshman all along is somebody, another phrase Jason used was knowledgeable about what's going on. Well, you can attend hearings, you can attend meetings, you can read things and not know a thing about it, as we see with our city commissioners.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop you because I'm running out of time.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your
call.
Thanks, Crystal. Really appreciate it. We are so minus on minutes. We're going to squeak in one last caller. Hi, Karen. Can you squeak it in 15 seconds or less?
I can, Joanne. I just wanted to reassure you that I and at least one other person I know has written to the whole city council and to Mayor Hales about the CRC and voting on September 7th against any changes to the appeal process that do not increase transparency, enable a strong role for the CRC, and allow public access to the complaint and appeals process. So that's it.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And you were excellent. You got squeaked right in. I want to thank you very much, Jason, for being here again. I want folks to know about the bearing witness, James Chassie. 10 years since his death, a celebration of and conversation, September 17th. I'm Joanne Hardesty. I'll see you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Thank you, Steve, for making us sound good as always. Have a fabulous day.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Joanne.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is gold. After story and never been.
Stand up for your right.
And good morning. It is KBOO, KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Don't give up the fight. Never giving up the fight, even on a hot Thursday morning. It's about an hour away from kicking off Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Then at 10:15 on Flashpoints, we'll take a closer look at the Kurds in Syria with New York Times Magazine author Robert F. Worth. Coverage of Yemen and the role of the U.S. in a deadly air campaign led by the Saudis, and the Election Crimes Bulletin with Dennis Bernstein and Greg Palast. Also today at 11 on Between the Covers, host Ken Jones interviews Zora O'Neill, author of the new book All Strangers Are Kin, Adventures in Arabic and the Arab World. And at 11:30, we'll hear the film show with SW Concert and Jen Chavez. That is all coming up this morning. Right after we hear from Teresa Mitchell, she's hosting Press Watch. It's the news you're not supposed to know. And that is next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Pan